This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this Latin American edition of the program, Chileans vote to tear up the country's Pinochet-era constitution in favor of a new charter drafted by citizens. Bolivians choose a protege of ousted President Evo Morales in their recent elections. U.S. authorities detain ex-Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto's defense minister on a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration warrant, and the United States and Brazil announce a mini-trade deal that could strengthen economic links between the two huge economies. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. After massive and often violent social protests last year sparked the demand for a new constitution, a vast majority of Chileans voted on Sunday, October 25th, to do just that. According to Reuters, members of a 155-seat constitutional convention will be voted in by April 2021 and have up to 1 year to agree on a draft text with proposals approved by a two-thirds majority. Among issues likely to be at the forefront are recognition of Chile's Mapuche indigenous population, powers of collective bargaining, water and land rights, and guarantees of more equal rights to health care, pensions, and education. In Bolivia, the triumph of Luis Arce in the first round of voting guarantees that the legacy of former socialist president Evo Morales lives on. The VOA newsroom reports that after allegations of voting irregularities last year, Morales resigned November 2019 after 14 years in power. As for the mini trade deal between Brazil and the United States, Christian Witton, a senior fellow at the Center for the National Interest, quotes U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien saying that, quote, the deal could be a prelude to a larger agreement in a second Trump term, close quote. Witton asserts that a major motivation of the pact and the greater engagement of Brazil is to thwart China's aspirations in South America. Well, we'll examine these developments along with why the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration detained the former Mexican defense minister and get an update on the coronavirus pandemic in the region with our two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and that's an organization here in Washington, and it's known as a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs. And Benjamin Gedan, he's deputy director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Latin American program, also based in Washington. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams as we all continue to practice social distancing. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Carol.
Let's go to you first, Eric Farnsworth. Let's talk about the Chile referendum. What's the significance and even symbolism of this referendum to basically build a post-Pinochet edifice for the country?
Well, Carol, thanks again for having me, and it's great to join you and your listeners again. This is a really symbolic vote. I think at the first level, it was in some ways a celebration of democracy. Chilean democracy is strong. The vote was free and fair. It was conducted peacefully in almost a celebratory atmosphere. It was historically high voter turnout, and almost 80% of the people who did vote voted in favor of change. So this was a very successful vote from a process perspective, and for those who supported the outcome, obviously very successful as well. The real question is now, what sort of change did Chileans vote for? And that's an open question, because voting for change is one thing, but now there are a lot of disparate voices, a lot of disparate visions for what Chile should be in the future. And it's up to the Chilean people now to try to figure that out, to hash it out in the context of a constitutional assembly that will convene next year. So that's, I think, point number one. Point number two, you know, in some ways, this is an outcome of Chile's success since the dictatorship ended and democracy returned. It's a recognition that growth and the economic model has been very successful at the macro level, but that at the micro level, perhaps the benefits of the economic model haven't reached all of society. In fact, they haven't reached all of society and need to be wider spread. And that's something that the people of Chile believed could not occur adequately under the constitution that they have now voted to take a new look at. I would make one final point. There will be an opportunity once the new constitution is actually produced for the people to vote whether to accept it or whether to keep the current constitution. In other words, if they vote to accept the new one, it means that they'll go forward with that one. If they vote to reject the new one, it means that the old one will remain in operation. So it's just a minor thing, but at the end of the day, they voted to develop a new constitution, and then they'll still have to vote to actually adopt it.
Turning over to you, Benjamin Gedan, for your take on this vote. Certainly, Chileans voted overwhelmingly against the Pinochet-era constitution, but give us a sense of what you think they're voting for, and remind us also when the dictatorship ended and democracy returned to Chile.
Chile has been a democracy since 1990, but they have been burdened with a symbolically really problematic constitution that was implemented under a brutal authoritarian regime. What they were voting for, however, is a diverse set of very ambitious changes to the way Chilean society is organized. And there's a real question as to whether constitutional reform is the right vehicle to achieve those goals. They want better and more affordable education, better and more accessible public health systems, more affordable, you know, life for retirees when they have a largely privatized pension system. And, you know, I think those are clearly noble goals. I think the income inequality has been stubborn and unacceptable in Chile, as Eric points out. And in fact, it has been really destabilizing. Last year, the start of this process was these very surprising, quite violent, wide-scale protests in Chile that now all of that energy, I think, has been channeled very productively into a conversation about constitutional reform. You'll have a vote for 155 members of a constitutional convention who will then have a very difficult task of cobbling together a document that speaks about universal rights, but also creates a political system that can, within the resources available, achieve these very ambitious goals. I think for now, Chile, as Eric points out, is a real model for the region where the social demands that have caused a lot of street level violence and uncertainty can be productively put toward a democratic exercise. The question is whether those demands can ultimately be satisfied by this constitutional reform process.
A very quick follow-up to both of you on Chile, then we move on to Bolivia. So over to you, Eric Farnsworth. To what extent do you think that this vote, this referendum, will actually tamp down the very protests to which Benjamin Gedan just referred?
It's a really important question, and one that really goes to the heart of where Chile is going. In other words, will the people be patient to see what the Constitutional Convention comes up with? And will they be willing to accept the necessary compromises, the balance that is going to have to be struck among all the interests of the country? Because, you know, by definition, this is not going to be a document that will satisfy everybody. And once the document is in place, it's going to take some time to actually implement and for the effects of all these really significant changes to work their way through the system. And if people aren't patient to allow it to do that, then the short answer, Carol, is no, it's not going to be the magic bullet that will satisfy everybody and reduce all of the tensions. But for now, it certainly has been a release of political tension, and all eyes will now focus in terms of the actual redrafting exercise.
Benjamin Gedan, it's not going to be a magic bullet necessarily, but to what extent do you think this vote may at least allay some concerns and even mollify the protesters?
I think significantly. I think for the time being, there's reason for Chileans to sit back and hope that the system will be more equitable. And I think that's critical because what we saw in 2019, not only in Chile, but in Peru, we saw it in Colombia, we saw it in Bolivia and elsewhere, was populations that simply didn't trust their elected representatives to promote the kinds of equality that Latin America desperately needs. And so Chileans right now will see a process in force that is meant to address those demands. Again, we'll see if Chile can ultimately pull this off. I think it's in a better position than most because it has a solid democracy and it has a growing economy that generates the kinds of resources necessary to be able to redistribute income and create wealth. Even a new constitution won't miraculously create the resources necessary to improve healthcare, education, pensions, and, you know, indigenous rights in terms of actual social spending in that community as well.
Gentlemen, on to Bolivian election results and the implications. So back to you, Eric Farnsworth. The protege of Morales won. We're talking about Luis Arce with a massive victory. Were you surprised at that victory? What is the meaning of that?
Not surprised at the victory itself, but perhaps surprised by the margin of victory. There was some question about whether he would win in the first round or whether it would go to a second round. But the overwhelming vote in the first round, I think, was significant. And again, here, the Bolivian people voted for change, but they did so freely and fairly and transparently. And so it was another positive exercise of democracy under different conditions, to be sure, than next door in Chile. But, you know, what happened a year ago when Evo Morales left ignominiously, you know, after trying to steal the election, was that many observers suggested now Bolivia is hopelessly corrupt. They'll never have another free and fair election, all of this nonsense. And the Bolivian people showed the way forward to be able to do that. So I think that was a very positive result from that perspective as well. Now the real question is, you know, how will he govern? Will he govern for all Bolivians? Will he govern just for his supporters in the MAS party? Will he be somebody who is close to Evo Morales, or will he separate, as other leaders have had to try to do across the region in other countries in similar circumstances? I think that's an open question. And I think it goes to the heart of if he'll be a successful president or not. I mean, if he tries to hew too closely to the line laid down by Evo Morales, that's going to be a divisive presidency that will be broadly rejected by many important sectors in Bolivia. If he seeks to have a more benign path, if you will, and to work to implement some of the policies that he was really a supporter of when he was finance minister for Evo Morales, then I think things will go much smoother. But Bolivia does need a time of healing. It does need a time for all of its sectors to come together. It's a traditionally divided society geographically, racially, Carol, as we've talked in the past, economically. So there are cleavages in the society that really do need to be healed going forward.
Turning to you, Benjamin Geden, Bolivia's former UN ambassador said that ultimately MAS, and that's the party of Evo Morales and, of course, Luis Arce, that Luis Arce, or rather MAS, did not win because of Evo Morales, but in spite of him. So many are saying that notwithstanding Luis Arce is of the same party, he intends to govern differently. He even went so far as to say that Evo Morales' bid for a fourth term was an error. So how do you think he can thread this needle, that is, Luis Arce?
It'll be difficult, but I think we've seen a lot of examples actually in Latin America where political protégés have created a lot of space once they've taken office. But I mean, if you look at Juan Manuel Santos, the former president of Colombia, became a rival of Álvaro Uribe, who was his political mentor. We saw the current president in Ecuador, Lenín Moreno, who has moved so far away from Rafael Correa that, in fact, Correa, his predecessor, when he was vice president, Correa was president. Correa is now a fugitive from justice in Ecuador. So there's been lots of examples of that. But again, you also see presidents like in Argentina, President Alberto Fernandez, who is very much conditioned by his political mentor, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who chose him to run for president, and she is now his vice president. So there's lots of different models for how political protégés in Latin America behave. What I'll say is, so far, the signals are fantastic and very encouraging. I mean, Arce is a technocrat. He's, you know, less charismatic. He's not looking for a personality cult like Evo Morales was. As you mentioned, he was critical of this attempt by Evo to run for a fourth term, despite a national referendum that denied him that possibility. You know, he is a socialist, self-proclaimed. He supported nationalization of key economic sectors. His economic model is not going to please the private sector everywhere. But so far, he has said Evo Morales is welcome to come back to the country. They're already dropping criminal charges, but he's insisted Morales won't have any formal role in the government. I think it's politically savvy for two reasons. Number one, you know, Evo was losing popularity. Despite some real successes in social inclusion, in finally giving representation to the majority indigenous population in Bolivia, you know, there were some real authoritarian instincts that were coming to the surface in the last years of Evo's very long presidency. And there was a reason that the election was so close and that Evo had to resort to fraud to try to win that fourth term. And for that reason, there was an uproar and the military nudged him out of the country. And I believe that for those reasons, and also the goal of unifying a very divided Bolivia, that the president-elect, you know, will try to navigate a moderate center-left course. We'll see. I mean, Evo Morales, it's his party, the MAS party. He created it. He retains the loyalty of many Bolivians, particularly the indigenous community. And his presence in the country won't be ignored by his very strong base. But as of now, the signals are encouraging.
Indeed. Analysts say that Arce's victory signals that renewal may be possible and that he is a much less polarizing figure. But as you said, we shall see.
I would just add that this was a rejection of the very right-wing, highly conservative, divisive interim presidency of this woman, Jeanine Añez, who sort of came out of obscurity and ideally will return to obscurity. And so mismanaged her interim presidency through really extreme divisive politics that she assured the return of the MAS party and the election of the MAS candidate.
So that's a very interesting point. We'll have more in just a moment. First, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Benjamin Gedan, from whom you just heard. He's Deputy Director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Latin American Program. They both join me via Microsoft Teams, and we are discussing the most recent news from Latin America. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ronix Abuya, and he's from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page or send an email to encounter@voanews.com. First to you, Eric, what about the DEA warrant for the former defense minister in Mexico? What does this mean, and what does it mean for U.S.-Mexican relations?
It's a deeply embarrassing outcome on several levels. First is that the United States' relationship with Mexico is always complicated, and narcotics is always at the center of that, and that it's taken years to develop the sort of trust required between both countries and the security establishments to try to adequately address and cooperate in what has been called the war on drugs. The Mexican military has traditionally resisted participating in that because of the potential for corruption, but over time has been drawn in terms of security within Mexico on the counter-narcotics account. So this has been a long time development and slowly gotten to the point where the U.S. and Mexican militaries have begun to really cooperate. So to have the former head, General Cienfuegos, alleged to have been involved directly in cartel activity is deeply concerning. The second thing is that this is going to set back for a long time, perhaps, the institutional cooperation between the U.S. and the Mexican militaries. Those who remember their history of North America recall that the U.S. and Mexico have fought several times over the years, and it's not been a good relationship between the two militaries. And in fact, Mexico's military has strongly resisted in the past, and that has taken a lot of time to break down. So now, again, to have a celebrated figure at the top of the Mexican military pyramid who was lauded by the United States, who was given awards, who spoke glowingly of the institutional relationship between the militaries, now incarcerated for drug trafficking, that is a setback.
Over to you, Benjamin Gedan, for your take. Several of Mexico's former top-ranking so-called drug war officials have been implicated in narcotics. Now we have General Salvador Cienfuegos. To what extent do you think this also poses a setback in terms of institutional cooperation between the United States and Mexican militaries?
What I hope it does is motivate a renewed focus on corruption in Latin America. That has fallen from the U.S. agenda for the region, most dramatically in the Northern Triangle of Central America, where the United States let two anti-corruption agencies disappear in recent years. Those were in Honduras and Guatemala. And we simply haven't prioritized the fight against corruption. I think this is just a reminder that you can't have strong democratic functioning institutions, including or maybe especially among the defense and security sectors, unless you have transparent governments.
Gentlemen, I'd like to get a quick COVID status. So, Eric Farnsworth, the COVID pandemic, has it worsened, improved? How do you see it writ large in Latin America?
Writ large, it's still not under control. And the very worrisome aspect is that several of the countries which took strong steps early and, in fact, were praised initially by the international community for the steps they took have now found themselves right in the very epicenter of a new outbreak, Argentina being one of them, Peru, Chile, others. This is very concerning. It doesn't seem as if anybody has the answer at this point other than to wait for a vaccine and work to get that vaccine, hopefully with high efficacy rates, as quickly and cost-effectively distributed to the populations as possible.
Benjamin Gedan, it sounds like Latin America is following in the footsteps of the United States and Europe. We're seeing setbacks. We're seeing greater numbers of infections. What's your take?
It's disappointing because unlike the United States, a lot of these countries that Eric references actually had very nicely coordinated, aggressive national responses to COVID-19. Argentina was one of them. It was recognized by Time magazine for its response. And yet it recently exceeded 1 million cases. The outbreaks are no longer concentrated in the Buenos Aires region. They're as far south as Ushuaia. You now have almost 11 million cases confirmed around Latin America. Some of the top numbers of cases in the world include, you know, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia as well. Peru has been devastated. So it's bad on a lot of levels because even the aggressive, conscientious public health responses have proved inadequate. And that means that all of that economic suffering was for nothing.
Gentlemen, for our last question, this is a twofold question. What about the U.S.-Brazil mini trade deal between two populists, U.S. President Donald Trump and Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro? To what extent can this be sustained if Mr. Trump does not win a second term? And secondly, how do you think U.S.-Brazil relations will develop should Mr. Trump not gain the second term and a Biden administration is ushered in? Eric Farnsworth.
Well, on the Brazil agreement, it was a step forward. The U.S. relationship with Brazil has been fraught for many years, and the two presidents now do have a relationship that would indicate that a lot of progress can be made on certain issues that have heretofore been very problematic, and trade is one of those topics. The agreement that was announced some days ago is a step forward. It's not a dramatic advance. It's not a free trade agreement. It only covers certain things of a fairly technical nature. But in order to have a dramatic impact and to really solidify economic relations between Brazil and the United States, it will require a further advancement of these issues. Under a President Trump in a second term, I think the relationship with Brazil would continue broadly along the same trajectory, which would indicate a continued focus on economic cooperation. If Vice President Biden is elected, I do think that the relationship with Brazil will change. It will be focused much more around issues of global environment, global climate change, issues in the Amazon, and social development issues. And if that's the case, the politics will make it more difficult to advance on a trade agenda.
The last word to you, Benjamin Gedan.
Sure, and thanks again for the invitation. It's been a great discussion. I love Eric's optimism about trade in the future between the United States and Latin America. I share his belief that expanding trade both within the region and internationally through free trade agreements is probably the best path for Latin America to start recovering from the devastating economic impacts of the pandemic and the sluggish growth that it suffered, frankly, since 2014. I am less optimistic that either a second Trump term or a Biden administration could actually squeeze meaningful agreements out of the region. That's in part because two of its biggest economies, Brazil and Argentina, remain highly protectionist. I mean, the Brazilian government is less so, but Brazilian private sector certainly remains great fans of high tariffs. And frankly, even if they could be dragged along, the issues that Eric has raised about environmental concerns above all could really disrupt a trade agreement between a Biden administration and Brazil in the same way that it is disrupting a trade agreement between Brazil and other Mercosur countries and the European Union, not to mention Argentina, which has recently elected a highly protectionist government that is opposed even to the Mercosur agreement, let alone serious trade conversations with the United States. What does that mean? It means that we would again be talking to members of the so-called Pacific Alliance, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, and Chile. If the United States returns to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, again, you see Chile, Mexico, and Peru are there, maybe in the future Colombia. So there would be a free trade conversation to have in Latin America. But unfortunately, I don't think it would be as grandiose as an agreement that covers much, let alone all of the region.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this Latin American edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and Council of the Americas, and Benjamin Gadan, Deputy Director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Latin American Program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo and Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.